Hi, my name is Manahan Naqvi.
And my name is Savannah Willett.
And this is Progressing Planning, a podcast series on the role of planning in fostering change in contemporary society. In this episode, we'll be talking with Fizza Sajjad, an urban planner and researcher.
She is a PhD candidate at the LSE in Human Geography and Urban Studies. Her research interests focus on questions of land, housing, transport, and the politics of infrastructure development. She's worked on affordable housing development, gender equity and transport planning, and dispossession in rapidly urbanizing cities of the Global South, particularly in Lahore, Pakistan.
So, Fizza, you recently wrote an article on the Orange Line Metro Train project in Lahore and its impact on dispossessed marginal communities. For context, the Orange Line Metro Train is one of the largest metro projects under China's Belt and Road Initiative. Built as part of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, the Orange Line claims to offer an affordable and environmentally sustainable option to travel across one of South Asia's most transport-starved and congested cities, Lahore. Could you tell us a little bit about this research and what made you interested in studying planning and related issues such as dispossession?
Yes, absolutely. But first, I just wanted to say thank you for inviting me and for having me on this podcast. And I'm really looking forward to today's discussion. So yes, I recently co-authored an article with Dr. Amara Maqsood, which focuses on dispossession around the Orange Line Metro Train project in Lahore. And we looked at the ways in which affected residents attempt to negotiate and survive state-led demolitions of their homes. But to give you a little bit of background, this was part of a two-year research project that aimed to examine urban development in two South Asian cities, so in Lahore in Pakistan and Colombo in Sri Lanka, where state-led development had resulted in the dispossession and relocation of working-class communities. So we specifically aim to study the consequences of such dislocation in both cities. And, you know, typically we have a lot of evidence of the crippling impacts of demolitions, but we do not know enough about how families cope in the aftermath. So in Lahore, we tried to look at that impact in two residential neighborhoods where the government had acquired land for the construction of the project. So we started our research actually after the demolitions had taken place and families had moved away to their other neighborhoods. But what we learned was that in both neighborhoods, families had been living together since partition from India in 1947, and they had expanded, consolidated their houses over decades, adding rooms, making improvements as and when they had resources. One of the neighborhoods was home to approximately 30,000 residents, of which 2,000 were directly affected and 8,000, by some accounts, indirectly affected. The other neighborhood was home to about 50 to 60 families, of which 18 were impacted. So we tried to understand what life was like prior to the demolitions, the ways in which the government attempted to acquire land, how residents resisted and influenced decision making, and then how they fared after they moved to their new neighborhoods. And, you know, I mean, I can speak about any of these aspects as you like, but critically, what we learned through this project was that resistance makes a really critical difference in securing more favorable outcomes. But there are clear limits to how much people are able to influence decision-making in the city of Lahore and successfully propose alternative visions. So we saw that after significant opposition to the project, the state displayed a willingness to negotiate on compensation amounts, but it wasn't willing to negotiate in terms of offering alternative housing despite people's request for it. It also wasn't willing to negotiate on the project route itself. Many families had asked if they could just change the route just by a little bit. And during our interviews, we had a chance to speak to the chair of the government committee that had looked into community grievances. And he said that this was because they had agreed to the route with the Chinese contractor, which, again, you know, raises a lot of questions about who determines the shape of urban development in our cities. So interestingly, you know, not all residents we spoke to opposed the project itself, but they opposed the process through which it was implemented and one that didn't account for their voices or needs. So just to kind of come back to your question about my interest in planning and an issue such as dispossession, my interest really stems from a desire to imagine more inclusive cities which prioritize investments for low-income groups and aim to limit social exclusion. For me, planning as a discipline offers the tools to first understand these changes that we see around us, but also to intervene to address urban inequality that increasingly has come to define our cities. And I guess I was also more interested in issues of housing justice and thought this would be a good way to advocate for a way to bring about programmatic and policy level changes.
Thank you for that wonderful overview of your research. I think this question of who determines development is particularly important, especially in Pakistan's case, where, as you mentioned, there are both local actors and international actors at play. So moving on, over the past few years, there has been an increase in the number of private gated communities in Lahore. What do you think the impact of these has been on the city as a whole?
Yeah, so there has been a mushrooming of private gated housing developments in Lahore and in recent decades. So if we contextualize this a little bit, this trend really takes off first in the 1980s, which is a few years after the formation of the Lahore Development Authority, which, as you may know, it's the city's primary planning and regulatory authority. So the LDA put in place processes to approve the applications of private sector entrepreneurs, companies, and cooperatives to launch new housing schemes in the city. This is also a time when the government was incentivizing the private sector's organized involvement in land and housing development. And interestingly, remittance inflows from Gulf states had begun to increase significantly, and it's said that they contributed to a boom in the real estate sector. And I think it's also important to remember that this is also the time when work was initiated for the first four phases of the military-led Defense Housing Authority, which was then known as the Lahore Cant Cooperative Housing Society, which again offered high-quality suburban lifestyle for its residents and retired military personnel. So over the years, as we've seen, new gated, low-density planned developments have continued to be built primarily along the south and southwest corridor of Lahore, through the conversion of agricultural land for residential use, while the DHA has expanded on the eastern end of the city. So if we try to think about the positives of the proliferation of private gated housing developments, one could argue, as is frequently done by proponents of private-led housing development, that they've been able to step in where the public sector was lagging, they've been able to meet the housing needs of a growing population, and they've been able to, in some cases, ensure high service delivery standards in a relatively secure, quote-unquote, environment. Yet, although you know there's a wide range of private gated housing schemes, housing in approved schemes in Lahore remains mostly out of reach for a majority of the population. In Lahore, based on certain current estimates, the house price to income ratio is roughly 16 to 1, whereas globally a 5 to 1 ratio is considered to be more acceptable, and this gap is increasing. So while these are meeting the needs of a growing population, these are meeting the needs of a subset of the population, mostly high and middle income groups. And in most cases, they aren't only catering to the end user or the person or the family that's going to come live there, but also to speculators and investors who don't have an interest in actually living on that land itself. And so it's for this reason that we're seeing that it isn't uncommon for housing units within such developments to remain largely vacant for well over a decade. And again, this sector has been extremely lucrative for those who've been involved with it. And so that's also contributed to a frenzy for land, with more and more land being converted in peri-urban peripheries. And more than private schemes, really, it is DHA-led developments that are at the forefront of this trend. So if we want to think about the impact of these developments on the city as a whole, what we have now are low-density enclaves of varying scales across the city. And Lahore City's growth has been characterized by unplanned sprawl, which is becoming more prevalent. There are actually now an equal number of schemes that have been developed without approvals from the Lahore Development Authority as there are ones that have gotten approval. So much of this growth is unplanned. This growth is also car dependent, which means that distances are growing and there's infrastructure being built to accommodate car users. Environmentally, what we see is that the air quality is deteriorating, the CO2 emissions from vehicles are increasing. In a sense, livability in the city of Lahore, despite the promise of high-quality living in private gated schemes, is declining overall. And there also appears to be greater stratification within the city, with private elite quarters having better service provision than low to middle-income neighborhoods, with better and they also have better access to educational and health facilities. And so there's a lot more work that has to be done on this, but it seems that inequality is widening in the city as a whole. And in some ways, the reshaping of our urban landscape is harmful to all. The ecological damage that we see around us doesn't discriminate by class. But yes, overall, private gated housing schemes are a central feature of our cities. They're also shaping aspirations, and we have to accept that these are highly sought after sites. But the key question is why they have come to be so. And as you've asked, how this impacts the city as a whole, as well as what this means for the city's future, But if we continue this way, we are looking at a highly unequal and unsustainable city going forward.
Yeah, all of the points that you brought up are incredibly important. And in particular, this idea of questioning who this housing is for and looking at whether it is improving the general livability within the city or not. So moving on, to what extent do you think spatial interventions can contribute towards greater mobility for women in Pakistan?
So we know, and there's growing scholarship on this, that mobility and travel behavior, experiences in public spaces are highly gendered. And this is the case across cities globally. In the case of Lahore, too, for instance, we know that public spaces, with the exception of some bazaars, markets, are male-dominated and not very conducive for women in terms of access or enjoyment. And so if we look at data from the Lahore Urban Transport Master Plan from 2012, it helps put a number to that problem, just to get a sense of the scale at which this problem exists. So again, this is data that's 10 years old, but just to get a reference point, in Lahore, according to that data, there were 12 million trips made on any given weekday, and 75% of these trips are made by men, while only 25% are made by women. So, you know, even if there are problems in the way that they gather the data, what this suggests is that there is a stark difference in the frequency with which men and women travel in Lahore. And this is Lahore again, right, which compared to other smaller cities has better transport infrastructure. But that's not the only thing. When women do travel, as a proportion of their total trips, they depend more on walking than men do, and on rickshaws and chingchis are motorcycle-driven rickshaws, than men do. And what we also see is that men are users of motorcycles in the sense that they drive motorcycles, whereas women mostly use them as passengers. So the difference doesn't simply exist in terms of the frequency of travel, but also in the modes that are used. And there are several reasons that contribute to this: affordability, safety, social norms, etc. But again, that's also not it. You know, when women do travel, many of them experience significant challenges that range from concerns about safety, of harassment, and social stigma. So keeping all of these things in mind and keeping the differences in travel patterns and experiences, there is absolutely, you know, significant scope for spatial interventions to facilitate greater mobility. I think this is a book that most of us have read, but that book on Mumbai, Why Loiter, the authors have made a really critical point there about how access to public space is dependent also on material facilities and on infrastructure and design. And so, you know, cities need to provide infrastructure that meets the needs of both men and women. And there's a range of things that can be done. For starters, what we can do is we can improve access to public transport. There was a study carried out by the Punjab Commission on the Status for Women a few years ago. And what they found was that a majority of women in the province of Punjab still don't have access to public transport, and more so in rural areas. But even in major cities, public transport services are unreliable, they're not well integrated, and they require significant improvements. And existing infrastructure doesn't cater to the elderly, the disabled, women with children, for pregnant women. And, you know, aside from that, given that women depend more on walking than men do as a proportion of their trips, women's mobility can also be supported through the construction of sidewalks, through streetlights, public toilets, by improving bus stops. There are a number of things, including sexual harassment training for public transport officials and the police. So such spatial interventions alongside legal and programmatic interventions can certainly help facilitate women's mobility. And we have to see and assess whether they induce new travel, whether they induce unaccompanied travel, more comfortable travel. And also, you know, it can be seen whether they help facilitate educational outcomes and labor force participation. But, you know, the question of gender and mobility is, of course, not simply a technical matter that can be solely addressed through transport and design interventions. And it has deep roots in the way that society functions and is structural in nature. So there's a growing body of work that focuses on gender and planning across cities globally, which argues that differences in mobility patterns and experiences also have to be understood in connection with decision-making in the private sphere. They have to be understood in connection with gender norms, the gender division of labor, as that shapes differential access to public spaces. So in my view, this is also a question of politics. It's a question of social movements and of thinking about how, at both the community and the city scale, we can open up more space for women going forward.
Definitely. So, taking this forward, what successes, particularly for women, have you seen in transport planning in Lahore? Do you think that this is affected by class?
Yeah, so what successes have I seen in planning? Well, if we look at Lahore's transport master plans, and there are three of them, they only make references to gender when describing the city's population distribution. The latest transport master plan from 2012 makes references to differences in travel by gender, but it makes no reference to these differences in its recommendations. So there certainly aren't a lot of successes to celebrate at that end. But in recent years, there have been a number of transport interventions across cities in Pakistan that have attempted to facilitate women's mobility, either by creating safe physical spaces for women to travel, such as the Pink Bus in Lahore, or there was the Zong RTA project in Rawalpindi, or by attempting to change norms around women's presence in public spaces. So there was a Pink Rickshaw program which tried to recruit female rickshaw drivers, but then more recently there was a Women on Wheels project, which is the initiative by the Punjab government, that's been particularly interesting as it's been providing, as it was providing women training on how to use motorbikes and scooters, and was also offering loans to purchase these in the hopes of helping meet their commuting needs and constraints on mobility. And this program too also builds on advocacy efforts by a local NGO called Punjab Lok Sujag. But, you know, we need more evaluations of the program. But, you know, just in terms of observation, we can see that there are more women now driving motorcycles than we did a few years back, which suggests that there has been some success in this space. But on the whole, there have been quite a range of small-scale interventions, all of which are commendable, but all of the interventions have been implemented or been tested out over a very short period of time, and have been discontinued primarily due to financial reasons. There's also very limited documentation of the initiatives themselves, their design, the amount of subsidy required, the reasons for success or failure, the lessons that were learned. So the social benefits to women are entirely undocumented and haven't been studied systematically. So there are major areas for improvement at the moment. And we need to develop transport policies that holistically take into account women's transport needs. And also, we need to actively recruit, train, and promote women to leadership positions and key transport agencies. Currently, this is predominantly a profession dominated by men, and we remain very far from integrating gender in transport planning. But there is, of course, a lot more debate on this issue now, so I hope that perhaps that can lead to something more positive. But regarding your second question around the question of mobility and class, so, you know, we know that women are not a homogenous group, and their mobility also depends on class, it depends on ethnicity, on age, marital status, etc. So women from higher income groups are more likely to have access to a private vehicle or to ride-sharing options than women from working class groups. And although women who rely on private vehicles for travel purposes also face a number of constraints, including the threat and the experience of harassment, but the uncertainty, the harassment, and the anxiety that women experience on a daily basis when they don't have the luxury of using a private vehicle is critically different from those who have such access. So recently, Arif Hassan, Mansoor Raza, and the Urban Resource Center published a book on Karachi's public transport. And there's a chapter in the book on women's transport issues, which has been compiled by Anadil Iftikhar and the Urban Resource Center. And that documents women's everyday journeys in Karachi. So these are women from all backgrounds, but with a focus on domestic help workers, on caretakers at offices and schools, on students, etc. And these journeys, they're painful to read. You know, there are repeated accounts of leaving really early in the morning, walking for hours to cut down on costs, on buses breaking down midway, on extreme rash driving, not having seats, on this constant kind of threat of harassment or harassment itself, and then making it to work and having your payment being docked, and then lots of women making choices about the universities that they want to attend based on transport options, about the jobs that they will consider based on the transport options available to them. So there are very high costs associated with the absence of a dignified transport system. And women from working class groups really bear the brunt of all of these costs. So class definitely plays a really critical role here.
Thank you for that nuanced overview on the successes for women, but how that is affected by class. So needed. And moving forward, what do you foresee to be the future of Lahore's urban planning?
So what we're seeing now is that there is more and more sprawl. There is increasing dependence on cars and private vehicles. There's not enough investment in public transport or affordable housing. Green spaces themselves are shrinking. There is a lack of sewage treatment facilities or effective solid waste management. The air quality has been worsening, and there's a clear lack of clean drinking water across major neighborhoods in Lahore. So it's pretty apparent that low-income households are struggling to make ends meet and are living in neglected neighborhoods with poor service delivery. There's also an excess supply of labor, as there isn't enough employment in productive sectors like manufacturing. And what the pandemic has also shown us is that we need a more comprehensive social security system. So at the same time, Lahore's institutions are completely unaccountable. So on the one hand, we have the Lahore Development Authority, which is an agency that is directly responsible to the provincial tier of the government and not to the citizens of the city itself. This means that accountability channels are limited here. Alongside, we have the Defence Housing Authority, which is answerable to the Ministry of Defence, and it has the power to carry out land development activities at a scale, at whatever scale it likes, really, without any interference from existing regulatory authorities, such as even the LDA. So this, again, reduces the ability of residents to hold decision makers accountable. So personally, I don't see things changing for the better in the immediate future, unfortunately. But, you know, you can't work in this field without any form of hope. And I hope that we can continue to exert significant pressure on key decision makers, whether that's from the top, as a discourse around sustainability changes globally, or the bottom through activism, through advocacy for policy and programmatic changes. And, you know, I don't want to discount the efforts of those who are trying to make this a livable city, but there's definitely a lot more that has to be done, and we really need a radical rethinking of the approach that we are continuing to take at the moment. And without that, it's inevitably going to get much worse.
I appreciate the balance you struck between being realistic but also hopeful about the future. Very well said. Now, as we move towards the end of this podcast, this is one of my favorite questions to ask. Is there a question you've always wanted to answer but never have been asked?
I don't think I've ever really had the desire to be asked a specific question myself. I've always been interested in asking questions, and I suppose that's something we should all encourage, to ask more questions, be more curious about all kinds of changes that are happening around us, why they're happening, who they're benefiting. But I guess I'll use this opportunity to say that, and of course I'm not the only one to say this, but I feel that in Lahore, this is not so much a question, but I've always hoped that we can slightly shift the discourse around housing supply from one that focuses on housing shortages to one of oversupply. So currently there is an oversupply of housing options for high-income groups. But the current discourse around housing supply focuses on shortages, and that discourse fuels this oversupply rather than the supply for those who need it. So I really feel that, you know, we need to expend our energies on calling out the oversupply and problematizing it, which is continuing to distort the market, and then think also, of course, prioritize housing solutions for those who are most in need of it. I hope that makes sense, but really, like, I think that's where the problem lies, and we need to just be talking about it a bit more.
Definitely. It's like, in order to properly address a problem, you need to understand exactly what it is, and you need to clarify misconceptions and misunderstandings. So to conclude today, I have one last question for you, Fiza, and it's a more personal angle on what you feel planning is or should be. So to conclude, do you have a favorite city?
Yeah, that's a difficult question. I think there are definitely a few cities, I guess the ones that I would want to keep returning to, that perhaps would qualify for the favorite city list. I'm thinking Mexico City, Istanbul, Colombo, and certainly London as well makes it to that list. I think in terms of what a city should look like, for me, it's a place where you're able to really be yourself. A place where you have access to facilities such as adequate housing, so secure transport, employment opportunities, where you're able to have opportunities for leisure, personal security, as well as access to basic facilities and services. I think all cities have a lot of work to do in that regard, but those would be a few on my list.
For sure. So thank you for listening to this episode, and thank you to Fizza for talking to us. For more information, you can visit our blog at this address, www.blog.lsc.ac.uk/progressingplanning. See you soon!